All right, so I'm not going to repeat this at the end of the class. I said last class, although I realized I didn't put the lecture up, but I will get it up today, that I thought I would need next week to have the first exam, and that's actually not true. We're going to be able to get to it after this class, but it's going to require just a little extra homework to get there, but I'll talk about that once we're done. All right, models of federalism. One of the things that I ask you to do is to read that little blurb that I put on my website, Advantages and Disadvantages of Federalism. That analysis was done based on the perception of federalism in 2002. I forgot when the book that I took that from was published, but it was a long time ago. And obviously, we're talking nearly two decades ago, and as time passes, attitudes continue to shift. I know it's hard for you young people to understand that. You think the world is as you see it. But trust me, once you get into your 30s and you get in your 40s, and you think back to the way the world was when you were a kid, you're just going to see change, because change always happens. In politics, often is like a pendulum. Attitudes go back and forth. That's one of the reasons why the interaction between the federal government and the states have evolved. Because of change. Change in time, change in history, change in events. Do this real quick. Enrique and Lewis, right? Originally, it was the Venn diagram. Marshall Court wanted to flip it on its side because of the Civil War. It became a layer cake. The federal government cut off all the edges and surrounded the different levels of government. That was the attitude going all the way into the 20th century. But then, beginning in the late 1920s and early 1930s, events happened again that would shake up the model of federalism. Beginning with the election of Democrat President Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who himself, his election was a reaction to one of the biggest events in the 20th century, the Great Depression. This calamity gave those people who wanted to bring about change an opportunity to do that. And in doing so, they took the clear lines of the layer cake. We know what a state power is, we know what the county power is, we know what the local power is, and basically mixed it all up inside. And you ended up with more of a marble cake model, where you couldn't tell where the federal government, state government, county government, local governments began and ended, because everything was mixed up. Franklin Delano Roosevelt came to power promising to present to the American people a new deal. Change. Now, the nation was mired in an economic crisis. The stock market dropped 75% in value from its high in the 1920s into the first few years of the 1930s. One in every four people were unemployed. Millions of people lost their homes. They lost their businesses. They lost their farms. The nation had never seen anything quite like it. And the irony was, the people who were hardest hit were the people who were just trying to get by. But also the middle class was hit as well. So it wasn't just the poor people, it was the middle class as well. Because the middle class did stupid things with their money. And I I see it now, with your generation and all the gambling that, particularly the young men like doing, or wasting all their money on like Starbucks coffees and or marijuana or stuff like that, what in part caused the Great Depression is people took whatever savings they had, they mortgaged their houses, and they put it in the stock market. They bet that it would always win. Well, when the market crashed, they had nothing. They didn't save. They didn't have a rainy day fund. Now, I'm not saying that I'm better than anyone else I've ever come across. I just am cheap, and I work hard. I'm not afraid to buy clothes off the clearance rack in Walmart. I have, in cash, I've been working since I was 8. Always tried to save. Even if it was, I got a quarter here, so I'll put it away, or a dollar here, put it away. I am now in my 50s, and I could actually retire. I could have retired probably like 5 years ago. I have hundreds of thousands of dollars in cash. I have nearly $2 million in stocks and bonds and all the rest. Because instead of spending every dollar I had, I made sacrifices. I made choices. Understanding that if, God forbid, something happens, everything could go away. And think about what you experienced in your life, the chaos of the COVIDs. That was not nearly as bad as what happened to our, well, in your case, it would probably be our great-great-grandparents during the Great Depression, but that was the most disruptive experience in my lifetime. But here's the funny thing. I was fine. Because I had a cushion to fall back on. Although I was also deemed an essential employee and I was also working my brains out. But I know people that their company shut down. They got laid off. They had nothing. And if they didn't have that cushion, they could have lost their houses. A lot of businesses closed up. For the same reasons why the Great Depression was so hard. Well, Franklin Delano Roosevelt designed strategies, policies that collectively were referred to as the New Deal. The New Deal was one of the most sweeping expansions of federal power in the history of the United States. FDR pushed initiatives, laws that would essentially take control of all sectors of the economy. They would control agriculture. They would control the stock market. They would control every single industry in our economy. Unlike during the Progressive Era, where they were just experimenting, FDR wanted control. Now, here's the dirty little secret, and I'm not saying it to be controversial. I don't say things to try to be controversial. I say things that are based in historical fact. FDR was an admirer of what was going on in Europe. He was an admirer of the system that Benito Mussolini imposed in Italy. He was an admirer of the system that Adolf Hitler put into Germany, where the socialist governments, and by the way, fascism is socialism. It's where one party controls everything in society. Government, the economy, education, everything. He wanted to do that here. Because, ironically, one of the first countries to emerge out of the Great Depression in a booming way was Nazi Germany. Although, truth be told, one of the reasons why is because Hitler would take He would increase taxes on everybody. He would take half of the money and pump it into industries, and the other half would go into the private sector, but the goal was to boost up the military. So there was tremendous amount of government spending to build up their army. Oh, and he also passed social rules that caused all of the women to have to become traditional wives. They all had to leave the workforce and go back home. So he shrunk the amount of potential employees, which allowed all the men to get jobs. So I'm not saying that there was a Nazi miracle. There was smoke and mirrors. There were games that were played. But FDR saw that and said, well, if they can do it, we can do it too. He started implementing socialist labor policies where the government would make decisions for all areas of society. Why? Well, he believed government was the ultimate source of wisdom, not the people. He actually felt most people were too naive. I don't want to say he thought they were dumb, but he thought the common man was too naive. They didn't understand the big picture. So he wanted this big government state to come in and basically control everything for their own good. So what are we talking about? Well, he brought back the idea of the minimum wage, where the government would say what the minimum wage for people working are. He pushed for union expansion. He wanted collective bargaining rights. He pushed for the prohibition of child labor. Why? Well, you take the kiddos out of the workforce, just like Hitler did with the women, and now suddenly there's more jobs. He regulated all industries. He regulated agriculture. He actually told farmers what they could produce and how much they could produce and what they could sell it for. And how did he do it? He viewed every aspect of our society as being part of interstate commerce. The only thing that stood in his way was the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court, when FDR came in, was a centrist court, maybe center-right. So they weren't extreme conservatives, but they were mostly contextualists, meaning they believe that we have to follow what the Constitution actually says. And where in the Constitution does it say that the federal government has the power to set what you get paid for at your job? Where in the Constitution does it say the federal government can determine if you're a farmer how much you can sell your tomatoes for? Doesn't. So while FDR was using the crises to implement socialism, the Supreme Court began knocking these laws down for being unconstitutional. Justice Marshall, Marbury v. Madison, you know, judicial review. They were reviewing the laws and they were saying, no, you can't do this. All throughout the 1930s, case after case after case, the Supreme Court was ruling against the laws passed by Congress, signed into law by the president. One of the worst days for FDR happened in his first term, May 27th, 1935. Democrats at the time referred to that day as Black Monday. On that day, the Chief Justice, Justice Hughes, arranged for the announcement of three significant decisions that involved laws that were serving as the foundation of the New Deal. Wow. one involved a case similar to a case that's at the Supreme Court now, where FDR wanted to fire the head of the Federal Trade Commission, the FTC, because he did not want to allow FDR to implement some of his policies. Well, FDR wanted to fire him and put somebody in like he wanted. Well, interestingly enough, it was the Supreme Court that set the precedent that the Trump administration is trying to challenge. On that day, the Supreme Court said, no, you can't fire this guy just because you don't like his opinions. Second case involved a law that was passed by Congress that prohibited banks from foreclosing on family farms. FYI, if you don't pay your mortgage, the bank will foreclose on you. They'll take you to court and they'll force you to sell the house to pay back the money you owe. Anyone who buys a house knows that going in. Well, you had a whole bunch of farmers that were losing the farm, so Congress said, no, banks can't do that. Well, Supreme Court said, no, that law is unconstitutional. If you make a contract and you put yourself in debt, you have a legal obligation to pay that debt back. And if you can't keep the stuff for free. And lastly, one of the biggest laws was the National Industrial Recovery Act, in which the federal government would basically order every single factory in our country, tell them how many hours they could operate, how many goods they could produce, how many people they had to employ. Supreme Court said no, unconstitutional. By the way, all three cases were unanimous. So this wasn't a divided court. If you ever hear about a case where it's 5-4, that means the Supreme Court isn't like sending really a big message. It just means that if a little facts were a little different, you know, a justice could have gone the other way. All of these decisions were 9-0. The irony is, just like today, the court at the time had nine justices. Seven of them were appointed by Republicans. Two of them had been appointed by Democrats. So this was not a partisan decision. Both the D's and the R's worked together. So, similar to what the Democrats were doing when Biden was president, when the Supreme Court didn't rule the way politically they wanted it to, FDR proposed a radical change. He didn't want to just change the rules, he wanted to change the game. On one of his fireside chats, he said to the American people that it was time to expand the Supreme Court. And he proposed what would become known as the Judicial Procedures Reform Bill. He suggested that because these old men were too old, that for every judge over the age of 70 and a half, that there would be a new judge appointed. Well, at the time, 6 of the 9 were over that age. So that would allow him to appoint six. What's 2 plus 6? 2 plus 6? He wanted to inject partisan politics into the Supreme Court. Because if he could appoint 6 more Democrats, he believed the other 2 Democrats would play ball, and then suddenly, instead of losing everything, he'd start winning everything. Well, here's the thing. The majority of these judges, justices, believed in the independence of the Supreme Court. They weren't making these decisions because of politics. They were making these decisions because they were enforcing the Constitution. But FDR didn't care. So as the result of this move, before 1941, 5 of the justices that were on the court retired, plus 2 died. Six of the 7 were Republicans. 1 was a Democrat. What happens when there's vacancies on the court? The president nominates, and the Senate confirms. The Senate was controlled by a majority of Democrats. Each one of the new appointees was a New Deal Democrat.
The threat alone had a ripple effect that allowed FDR to do something that no president in the history of our country had ever done. Change the political direction of the court. And for the first time in the history of the United States, the court stopped using the Constitution as the basis of their decision and started using politics instead. From 1937, which is when the majority flipped, all the way up until the 1990s, as I have it up there, the SCOTUS would take a name. They did not, for almost 60 years, they did not declare a single act of Congress to be unconstitutional. They allowed Congress to pass whatever law they wanted. And there goes the checks and balances. And I would argue that's one of the reasons why our country is so off the rails. Because instead of playing by the rules, we started playing by politics. And where's the danger in that? Whoever is in charge changes, potentially every election cycle. So when the D's are in charge, they push more politics, which causes the Republicans to react, and then they push politics. And it's politics, 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 politics. Which is not healthy. Now, by the way, one of the most significant legal systems that would impact state, local government, and the private sector was a theory that this New Deal Supreme Court would develop, known as the preemption doctrine. The preemption doctrine is what I discussed when I talked about the immigration stuff in Minnesota. Under the preemption doctrine, federal law preempts state law, local law. So if there's a conflict between a federal act and a state act, the federal always wins. Even if that federal act may be questionable, may be unconstitutional, doesn't matter. Doesn't matter. And where do they get it from? Well, the supremacy clause. Talked about this before, because the supremacy clause was the basis that Marshall used in Gibbons v. Ogden. Because New York had given that monopoly of shipping lanes between states, the federal government has a right to nullify that because it's the federal government that controls interstate commerce. And how extreme did it get? Well, one of the most extreme examples that I can give you of the preemption doctrine is a case that occurred in 1992. Gade v. National Solid Waste Management Association. This case involved the transportation and storage of solid wastes. Trash. Poop. Radioactive material, hazmat stuff. New Jersey passed a law that required all businesses dealing in solid wastes to be permitted and inspected by the state government. And under that law, the state began denying new applications because New Jersey wanted to clean up the state. They didn't want any more trash going to New Jersey, because guess where all the New York City's trash goes? New York City doesn't have a dump. It gets put on barges and shipped across the harbor and all gets dumped in New Jersey. Well, New Jersey was sick and tired of taking all the New York City shit.
Literally,
no pun intended. So New Jersey, any company that wanted to start bringing stuff over there, they'd say, no. Well, the federal government came in and said, too bad. We can't have all this waste in the market capital of the United States. The federal government actually passed a law that said New Jersey had to take all of New York's waste. And New Jersey could do nothing about it. Preemption. Questions? Now, by the way, preemption also allowed for a shift that I alluded to before. How is it that Congress is able to do anything that it wants? Well, it now considers everything to be commerce. Which, again, take it back to something I said either last or the class before. Everything that you have on your person, everything that you own or will ever own or consume is regulated by Congress. Because everything you have is made of something that comes from somewhere else. And even if you get a wool sweater that was knitted off of wool that came from sheep that live in your town. Where does the sheep food come from? Where does the medicine that the farmer uses to keep the sheep alive? Where does the electricity that warms the barn? Where do the shears that the farmer buys? If there's some type of ancillary connection, Congress will regulate that transaction. Which was the ultimate goal of socialism. And there's nothing anyone can say about it. States can't stop it. Towns can't stop it. If the federal government says, you must bend the knee.
Why? Because the Supreme Court allowed every single law that was challenged, that was questioned, to stand. Oh, that's a duplicate.
And how crazy did they get? Well, this is one of the most craziest cases that I learned about when I was in law school. This case just blows my mind.
Wickard v. Filborn, 1942.
Congress passed a law during the 1930s that gave Congress the authority to create an agricultural regulating agency that I can't remember what the exact name is right now. This agency had the power to determine how much food a farmer could produce. The goal was to control prices. Because in a capitalist economy, a free economy, prices are determined by supply and demand. When there's too much supply, prices have a tendency to come down. When there's not enough supply, prices have a tendency to go up. Well, in order to get the country out of the Great Depression, oh, and by the way, 1941, we also entered World War II. The government decided they didn't want a free-flowing economy. They wanted to control everything. So they passed a law that said farmers could only produce, and I don't remember the exact number, a certain amount of tons of different commodities for sale into the economy. In comes Mr. Wickard. Wickard was a farmer. Can't remember if he was in Illinois or Indiana. He had a good-sized farm. Couple hundred acres. Under the law, he could only produce grain a certain amount of tons. And that roughly translated to him only being able to produce, I think he was growing wheat, on 40 acres of his farm. Well, the problem is if he followed the law, he was not generating enough money because the government set wheat prices artificially low. He wasn't making enough money to buy grain for his livestock. He had horses, he had cows, he had sheep. So he's like, all right, well, if this is all the government's going to allow me to sell, I can't afford to feed my animals. I need my animals, because that's where he was getting his meat from, that was who he was getting his milk from. Well, he basically said, all right, well, then I'm going to take another part of my farm, maybe about, say, 50, these numbers are not accurate, but say I'm going to take 15 acres, I'm not going to sell this wheat, but I'm going to use this to feed my own animals. I'm going to use my land to grow my food for my animals. Well, the agency, the agricultural agency, found out about this. And they went in and fined him, saying that this self-sufficiency was illegal under federal law. So he sued. He challenged it. He went into the trial court and he won. Then it got appealed and he lost. And the case gets all the way up to the Supreme Court, the newly packed New Deal Supreme Court. The Supreme Court ruled 8-1 that this act of growing his own food for his own animals for consumption on his own farm was in fact illegal. You know why? Because by him producing food on his own land, he was impacting interstate commerce. Because he was not buying. So because he was not buying food, another farmer was losing money. So if you choose not to buy, you are violating Congress's right to regulate interstate commerce. FYI, the basic premise of this statute is still in effect today. They just don't seek to enforce it as strictly. So think about that if you have like a tomato plant or a small backyard garden. You growing your own crops, you are technically violating federal law. Questions? Well, throughout the 1940s and 1950s, Congress kept passing more laws. Slowly eroding all of the checks and balances in our system. Slowly obliterating any barriers that once existed between the governments and the government and the private sector. Soon the federal government were telling businesses what they could produce, what they could sell it for. Oh! Who they could hire and who they could fire. What they had to give them in terms of benefits. What they had to allow them to work in terms of hours.
The government creeped into everything.
And by the 1960s, this pushed and resulted in the creation of what today we refer to as the welfare state, where the government literally regulates all aspects of your life from cradle to grave. Now, you don't even have to work, and the government will take care of you. The government will give you housing. The government will give you food. The government will give you education. Government will give you health care. Government will give you phones.
But of course, where does the money come from? Government doesn't make money. The government also taxes the people who are trying to do it the old-fashioned way. Trying to work hard and take care of themselves and their families. So they literally take the food off of one family's table to give it to their neighbor. The architect of the welfare state was Democrat President Lyndon Baines Johnson.
And he created or pushed for what he called the Great Society. Now, Johnson himself was a vile, vile human being on a personal level. And by the way, if you don't believe me, they have all of his White House recordings that you can actually go online and listen to. He was a alcoholic. He was a misogynist. He was a racist. He represented the way the Democrat Party used to be. And he's also an accidental president. The only reason why he became president is because Kennedy was killed. Well, Johnson was also implementing and ratcheting up and expanding the Vietnam War. So he came up with evil scheme. In order to keep the American people on the side of the Vietnam War, he started redistributing wealth. He started pushing for government assistance programs. He called it a war on poverty. And he did this only to get people to vote for the Democrats, so he could continue to expand the war in Vietnam. His words. They have recordings of him literally saying this. In fact, one of the most egregious things that is on tape was how he celebrated the passage of the Civil Rights Act. The Civil Rights Act was a law that was framed to ban discrimination against racial groups, ethnic groups, national and religious minorities, women. He realized that there was a constituency of voters that were up for grabs. African Americans. African Americans had traditionally voted Republican because it was the Republicans who freed them from slavery. It was the Republicans who fought against Jim Crow. Democrats created Jim Crow. Democrats created the Ku Klux Klan. Martin Luther King Jr. was a Republican. Well, he wanted to get the Africans and make them Democrats forever. When this law was passed, and I'm not going to say the N-word because he actually says it in the quote, he basically said, I'm going to get all of the N people to vote for me through their lives, the lives of their children, the lives of their great-grandchildren. Because who doesn't like free stuff? Well, this has been the law that the federal government has used in the last several decades to basically knock down any resistance to federal power, federal expansion of power. Because if you don't like what's going on, you could be labeled a racist. And nobody wants to be labeled a racist. It's politics. And by the way, they attacked everything that stood in their way, including the right of a business owner to run his business the way he wanted to run it. Now, by the way, I have always, throughout my whole life, as most people of my generation are, because we were raised under the words of Martin Luther King Jr., I don't judge people by the way they look on the outside. I judge them by the content of their character. And if I ran a business, there would be only one color that I would be interested in. The green. I would want as much of it as I could get. Now, of course, there are people who think differently, and that's pretty stupid. Including the owner of the Heart of Atlanta Motel.
Mortonton Rollinston was the owner.
And he decided in Georgia with a hotel that was right off Route 84 that he did not want African Americans staying in his hotel. So he had a segregationist policy. No blacks. Whites only. Well, after the law was passed, he was sued by the federal government for violating the Civil Rights Act. Again, I think it's a stupid idea. But if you own a business, the question is should you be able to make money however you want? Or do you want the government telling you who you have to do business with? Again, his model was dumb, but that's what he wanted to do. I would not stay there. I'm sure none of you would stay there. That's our choice. Well, the federal government found out of this, went in, and they fined him tens of thousands of dollars for violating the Civil Rights Act. Well, he sued. He fought back.
He argued that the Civil Rights Act was a violation of the commerce powers. How is he running a hotel, allowing the customers that he want a violation of interstate commerce? He also argued that this was a violation of the Fifth Amendment. Due process. They were denying him the right of liberty. The freedom to run his business as he wanted. It's his business, after all. And, sorry, I crack up about this one. His lawyer also argued that it was a violation of the 13th Amendment. That by the government taking control of the business, the government was enslaving him. Lawyers are just crazy, and that legal theory just amuses me, but to no end. But he was arguing this. Well, the case gets all the way up to the Supreme Court, and lo and behold, the Supreme Court said, first, right off the bat, no, there's no evidence of servitude. You know, the government didn't go in and put chains on you. The government didn't whip you. No. There goes that argument. The court then analyzed his other two arguments. Interstate commerce. Well, as it turned out, not only was his hotel near Route 84, but it was also off of the newly created Route 75. Intersections of two major highways. The government determined that 80% of his business were people coming from other states traveling on the highways looking for a place to stay for the night. If 80% of your business and money is coming from out of state, is not that interstate commerce? And lastly, as far as due process rights, the court determined, well, if Congress passes a law and it applies to all businesses equally, how is he being discriminated against? So they used money, the power to regulate interstate commerce, as the tool to tell the business who you had to have as customers. Questions? Some hardcore politics there. Hardcore politics. And it's very complex if you think about it. Because do you want the government, if you had a business, telling you how to run your business, or you want to run your business the way you think it's best? Even if I think it's dumb. But that's your right.
Well, the more more the Supreme Court made decisions like this, the more you had politicians elected to office passing laws that continue to expand the federal government beyond even the reasonable limits established by the Constitution, you started seeing a counter-revolution of sorts. Politicians began realizing it's not good to have the federal government that powerful. Because if the government literally has the power to tell you what you can do with your business, where's the limit? Are they going to start telling you what you can eat? Oh, wait, they already do that. Are they going to tell you what you can watch on TV? Oh, wait, they already do that. Are they going to tell you what you can learn in school? Oh, they already do that. You know? They're going to push, and they're going to push, and they're going to push. And what's the downside? Well, what happens if the person in power is someone who you disagree with? Guess what they have the power to do? And do you want to have that? So beginning in the late 1970s, beginning in the early 80s, you started seeing a counter-revolution led primarily by the Republican Party in opposition of the federal government and the powers that were given to it primarily by Democrats since the 1930s. It started pushing for a revision of the Federalist system, commonly referred to as New Federalism. Although, interestingly enough, New Federalism is really not something new, but rather it's the reverse. It's a retreat. The goal is to go away from the socialist-like system where you don't know where the limits are. Maybe to go back to the marble cake. You know, or at least you know there are kind of lines between where the federal government begins and ends and where the state begins and ends. The basis of this retreat was a legal theory that were devised by the men and women who worked for Richard Nixon. A legal theory called devolution. And this was ultimately the policy that was at the heart of what is called the Reagan Revolution. Notice, it's evolution with a D. Instead of changing and moving forward, the goal is to bring it back, to go backwards. Now, not to go back on the way people think, but to go back on the powers of the federal government. To go back to closer where they're supposed to be, according to the Constitution. Why? The argument was simple. The federal government's too big. Federal government's too powerful. Do you want a federal government that could erase you, make you cease to be? I don't think most people in their right mind would. So they started pushing for smaller government. To take the power from the federal government and put it back to the states where it belongs. And by the way, they had a very strong, and they still do, have a strong constitutional argument. Because in the Constitution itself, in the 10th Amendment, it literally says that. The 10th Amendment states that the powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution, nor prohibited to it by the states, are reserved to the states respectively, or to the people. To put it in plain English, if the Constitution doesn't say Congress can do something, they can't. It should be to the states. And by the way, if the states' constitutions doesn't say the states can do it, they can't. That means it's left to the people. So, where in any state or federal constitution does it say the government has the power to tell your employer how much money you make? It does not. Neither the federal government nor the state government have the power to establish minimum wages. That case has not been heard, but I heard there is one case working its way through the system. They're going to try to attack the very premise of minimum wage. Because who should determine your wages? Well, according to the Supreme Court, based on precedent, it's an agreement between you and your boss.
But here's the thing.
Does that mean the federal government's just going to give up on everything? No, because there are some federal programs that are beneficial. Like the idea of the interstate highway system. You know, those little red, white, and blue signs that have the route numbers on. Nothing in the U.S. Constitution that says Congress can make an interstate highway system. But it's very convenient, no? My daughter works down at Disney World. And before the semester started, we drove down there to visit her. 20 hours, 1,270 miles. Did it one shot. Very convenient. Turned around and did the same thing coming back. Very convenient. Much easier than having to go the old backwoods, having to go horseback, you know, taking weeks and months to travel up and down the coast.
So
the people that are involved in this devolution, they're not saying we need to undo everything. But we need to allow the level of government that should be controlling it or regulating it, control it.
So how are they going to do it? Money. And we'll talk about that in a minute.
Now, by the way, this attitude was championed when Ronald Reagan selected William Rehnquist to be Chief Justice. And by the way, this attitude is still viewed positively by the current Chief Justice, John Roberts. So for the last two courts, going back to the 1990s, this idea of putting things back in their place has been the mindset of the court.
One of the first significant cases to do this was handed down in 1995. This was the first time since 1937 that the Supreme Court said Congress went too far in a law.
U.S. v. Lopez. Again, like all the cases, you don't need to remember all the facts.
Bill Clinton becomes president in 1993. Congress, both the House and the Senate, controlled overwhelmingly by Democrats. They began passing a series of laws, including a law known as the Gun-Free School Act. This law stated that it was illegal to carry firearms on to school grounds. But here's the catch. The way the law was framed, it didn't talk about just the boundaries of the school property. It established radiuses around the school. So let's say here is our nice little school, like many of the neighborhood schools in Worcester. Obviously, you have the schoolyard, maybe you have a nice slide, you have some swings where the kiddos like swinging on, maybe you have a field in the back for some baseball. But right next door is a house and another house. in another house. Oh, by the way, across the street, houses. What this law said was that it applied to a radius around the schools, which meant that if you lived here, even if you had a license to carry, the state granted you a gun license, you could no longer possess a gun in your own home because it was within the zone. Well, ironically, the case did not start because of that scenario, but rather because of a student
who at the time was, I think, 17 years old, Alfonso Lopez Jr. He was a senior at a high school in Texas, and he was caught in school for bringing with him to school an unloaded 38 caliber revolver. Why? Well, when he was busted, he claimed he was delivering the gun because he was going to sell it for $40.
Well, he's arrested because he brought a gun on the school grounds. Now, here's the catch. At the time, Texas had no gun laws, which meant this kid was actually, in fact, in legal possession of this gun. It was his gun. He had it. And by the way, under the law, if you legally own something, you have a right to sell it. The only stupid thing that he made, the decision that he made, is he decided to sell it in school instead of going over to the other kid's house. Well, he gets arrested. The feds get word of this. The FBI comes in, and they're going to prosecute him under the Gun Free School Act. They want to make an example out of him. They want him to pay tens of thousands of dollars in fine and go away for decades. Why? Because the Clinton administration was anti-gun. Well, his lawyers challenge the constitutionality of the law itself. Again, if you have a legal right to conduct a transaction, where in the Constitution does it say Congress can tell you where you can conduct said transaction?
Well, the Supreme Court ruled 6-3.
They looked at the precedent going all the way back to Gibbons v. Ogden. They looked at the way the court defined commerce. Marshall defined commerce as the channels, the roads that the commerce travels on. Congress has a right to regulate that. The instrumentalities, the things or the people who are moving goods through commerce. Said Congress can regulate that. But the court put in a check and balance. Congress has the power to regulate commerce that substantially affects interstate commerce. And the court just asked a simple question. How does a kid selling a gun that he owns, which he has the right to do, for another kid, for cash, who has a right to buy it, how does that substantially affect interstate commerce? It does not. So the court said this whole law is unconstitutional. Because Congress doesn't have a right to regulate a small transaction within a zone around the school. Beginning with that case, more and more you see start seeing the Supreme Court striking these laws down and pushing it back to, again, ideally to the layer cake. But if you can't get back to the layer cake, at least the marble cake. The most recent example of this was something that was very, very controversial. That's 2022, by the way.
Dobbs v. Jackson's Women's Health Organization.
Does anyone know what the Dobbs decision did? This is where the current court, and by the way, not that I like doing ideology, I really don't, but our current Supreme Court six R, three Ds. All of the Republicans subscribe to devolution. They believe the federal government should only be able to do what the Constitution says it can do. Dobbs v. Jackson.
In this case, the Roberts Court ruled that abortion, which was deemed protected by Roe v. Wade as a right that the federal government has the power to protect, was in fact decided wrong. What did the court do?
Well, the court looked at the meaning of substantive rights. What is a substantive right? What is something that the federal government has a right to protect? And they did not look at the opinions of today. They looked at history itself. And they realized
that prior to Roe v. Wade,
abortion was viewed as abhorrent. That there were always efforts to do everything medically possible to save the life of the mother and the child. Because without children, you have no country. They also looked at the attitudes when the Due Process Clause was made. Because, by the way, that's what Roe v. Wade was based on. The Due Process Clause of the Fifth Amendment and the 14th Amendment. Supreme Court said, no, I could not imagine that when James Madison wrote the U.S. Constitution and the Bill of Rights, that he was thinking, yeah, we're going to use due process to protect a woman's right to have an abortion. No. And 14th Amendment. Now, that was always about trying to give equality to the freedmen, the slaves. I can't imagine the radical Republicans when they made that amendment thinking, oh, yeah, we're going to allow people to kill babies. So nothing in the history, nothing even in the implied interpretation of those clauses creates the right to an abortion.
Why?
Abortion is a medical procedure. And what level of government under our federalist system has the power to regulate health care. The devolution. It's not the federal government. It's the states. So they overturned federal protections. And abortion rights went back down to the states where they should have been all along.
Why? Because people have the closest connection to their state governments.
And if there's a majority of people in a state that want abortion to be legally protected, they will elect people and they will allow that law to be passed. Or if the opposite is true, it is true. So that's the reason why in Massachusetts, a woman literally has a right to get an abortion up to the moment the baby is born. Whereas in states like Florida, they pass the heartbeat bill. Baby has a heartbeat, it's a life, and it's protected.
Why? Well, that's what the people of Florida wanted. And guess what the people in Massachusetts wanted? And that's the way our system should work. Isn't it about we the people, after all?
All right, I don't have enough time to start the next section. I do not have enough time for another class. I only have about a quarter of a class worth of material. So I want to give you your first exam. So what I'm going to need to do when I get home is I'm going to make a little video and I'm going to cover the stuff. Just talking about grants and talking about the way the state's kind of forced to work together. Take about 15, 20 minutes. I'll record it, I'll post it, I want you to watch it. So that means before we see each other again, I want you to have your first exam. But I'm going to let you decide. When would you like to have your first exam? Would you like, because it's going to be online, it's going to be through Blackboard. Would you like to have it on Friday?
Meaning tomorrow?
That would be tomorrow, yes. Anybody want it tomorrow?
Well, what's the other option first?
Well, what's the day after Friday?
Saturday. Not tomorrow.
What's the day after Saturday?
Sunday.
And what's the day after Sunday? Because when am I going to see you next?
Tuesday.
So that means you can pick. Do you want it Friday, Saturday, Sunday, or Monday?
Personally, I wouldn't mind either Friday, Saturday, or Sunday. Because I don't have any other. I mean, I may have one other thing, but that doesn't take that long.
Let's go back to the beginning. By the way, it's only going to take you about an hour. I time it so it takes about an hour. So it's not going to be that bad. It's going to be like 30 multiple choice questions, two essays. Within the essays, I give you choices of two things you can answer. And one essay counts towards the 100 points. The second essay is extra credit. So if you get a perfect score on the test, you can get 110. I don't count spelling on the essays. I don't count grammar. The only time you'll run into an issue with me on your essays is if I take your response and I put it into my ChatGPT and AI detectors and it comes up with red flags, I'll give you a zero on it. But it does say that on my syllabus.
For the essay, do you want like 5 paragraphs or?
You can answer the essay in probably about a paragraph.
Okay.
3 or 4 sentences. Because I know not everyone can type fast. So you're not judged by the length. You're judged, are you just basically understanding what I'm asking? Are you answering? So you should feel no need to cheat. Yes.
Time.
Yes. So once you open it up, you're going to have whatever time I give you. I can't remember if I give you 60 minutes or 75 minutes. I might do 75 because that's a class. That's usually what I do in this section. So let's go back to the beginning. Friday, show of hands. Uh-oh. Saturday? Sunday? Jordy wants it tomorrow. Now, hold on. Not that I want to challenge you, but I'm going to give you extra stuff to do. So do you think a 24-hour turnover period is going to be enough for you to study and get everything you need to do? I would suggest you give yourself a couple of days. This is your first exam with me. You've never had me before. That you want to go back. You want to listen to the lectures for any classes you missed. You want to make sure you got all the notes. You want to read the chapters. Read that advantages, disadvantages of federalism. I would advise you to say maybe Sunday or Monday.
Maybe Monday.
Monday?
Yeah. Monday's not good for me.
Sunday, then.
Friday, Saturday, Sunday is better for me.
All right, well, again, we're going to go with the majority, and if you have an issue, you can send me an email, and I can link to get half of it back. So, would Sunday be okay for most of the people?
So, I have a question, because if you put it for Sunday, does that mean that they can do it any time before Sunday?
No. That means it will open up at 8 a.m. on Sunday morning, and it will stay open, like you can get into it and take it, until midnight. So you literally have the whole entire to do it at some point.
So it only opens on Sunday.
Right. But if you have work, you're going to send me an email and say you're working, and then I can program you to take it after. But I'm not going to let you take it before. So does the majority want Sunday? All right, very good. I will send you an email through announcements when I get that little recording done. I got to meet with the contractor, but as soon as that, I'm going to bang it out. If you have any questions about anything we covered, send me an email.
Oh, you too.